From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. 16 big dancers have dwindled to 8, and 8 will soon fandango to 4. Ahead on Only a Game, the latest March Madness results, and a look at Kentucky's chances after some uneasy moments against Cornell. Also, the New York Red Bulls' brand new soccer stadium, and the pitcher who started and completed 73 games in 1884, winning a respectable 59. Also, a look at the African roots of capoeira.
You know, history suggests that slavery at its height knew no region, no tribe. All their songs, their rituals, ceremonial chants, music, movements, martial traditions. Capoeira is a manifestation of this mix.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Baylor doubtless had some fun, thanks to one lace Darius Dunn. St. Mary's would have looked much smarter had they shut down Tweety Carter. But they didn't do so well enough. So last night in NCAA men's basketball action, Baylor beat upset-minded St. Mary's 72-49. Number 1 seed Duke was also a winner at the expense of number 4 Purdue 70-57. Number 6 Tennessee slipped by number 2 Ohio State 76-73. You knew there had to be an upset in there somewhere, right? And number 5 Michigan State edged number 9 Northern Iowa 59-52. In today's games, Butler will face Kansas State and Kentucky, about which more very shortly will face West Virginia. Cornell advancing to the NCAA men's regional finals would have been absurd, right? Well, it almost looked as if it might happen after the suddenly very big Red jumped out to a 10-2 lead on Thursday night against number 1 seed Kentucky, and Wildcat supporters are breathing a lot easier as a result of their team's 62-45 win over the Ivy League opponent. Here to discuss that game and Kentucky's prospects going forward is ESPN's Pat Forty. Pat, you've covered Kentucky basketball for a long time. What do you suppose was going through the minds of Kentucky fans when Cornell built that early lead?
Oh, I would say there was complete panic in the Commonwealth. short-lived panic, however. You know, I mean, it didn't take too long after that for reality to settle in. But for a few moments, at least, it was delirium for Cornell and devastation for Kentucky.
Well, as you say, it didn't take long, and in fact, Cornell was somewhat buried when Kentucky went on a 30-6 run of their own in that first half. Does Kentucky play that well and get the same result against West Virginia tonight?
This will be Kentucky's toughest game of the tournament, probably their toughest game of the season, because if you go back and look, they just haven't played that many good teams. You know, even their early schedule when they were playing North Carolina and Connecticut and Indiana and Louisville, those looked like big-name teams, but they didn't turn out to be that good. The SEC was only an average conference this year, so this will be probably the most relentless defensive team that they have played and best rebounding team they have played. Kentucky will have more talent once again, and I would expect Kentucky would probably win, but it will have to fight harder than it probably has all year.
Tell me a little bit more specifically about that talent. What is it that's made Kentucky as good as the team has been this year?
They have all the parts that you could possibly want. They have incredible size with DeMarcus Cousins, 6'11", 270, and Patrick Patterson at 6'8", 6'9", and 240. They bring a 6'11 guy off the bench. You know, it's NBA size. They have an NBA point guard, obviously, in John Wall, who's as fast end-to-end as anybody in college basketball. There's a lot to like there. The only things that you could possibly knock would be perimeter shooting and experience.
I guess it would be insensitive of me to ask you if you think that Kentucky's roster will bolt for the NBA this summer and that the team's accomplishments in this year's tournament will be nullified for one reason or another, perhaps having to do with the coach and his history.
I don't know why you would even suggest such a thing, Bill. I'm leaving it at that.
Assuming that Kentucky wins tonight, do we see them go all the way in the tournament? Can you look that far ahead?
they're going to be tough to beat. And if they do beat West Virginia, I don't know who else out there is going to beat the Wildcats. You know, the number one seeds have been eradicated from the other side of the bracket. And the way they're playing right now, they are absolutely the team to beat.
Pat Forde's 40-yard dash column appears on the ESPN website. He joins me from time to time to talk men's hoops. Thanks, Pat.
Thank you, Bill. Have a good one.
In the women's tournament, the unbeaten, untied, and very nearly unscored upon Connecticut Huskies have dominated the conversation. Joining me now is Jamel Elliott, the head coach of the University of Cincinnati women's team. She spent her coaching apprenticeship as well as her playing days at UConn. She was part of championship teams in both roles. Jamel, it's great to welcome you back to Only a Game.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Regarding his team's game against Connecticut tomorrow, Iowa State coach Bill Fennelly said, and I'm quoting now, "I haven't watched the tape of Connecticut's 90-36 win over Temple. I'm not sure I even should. One of my assistants is doing it." A good strategy by Coach Fennelly?
Well, I'll tell you what, I'll give you a story. The last time UConn lost, I forget the year it was, but we lost to Iowa State in the Sweet 16 round, and you know where the game took place? Here in Cincinnati. So I remember very well the last time we played Iowa State in the tournament, and they actually came out on top. So I'm sure Gino, he remembers that. He remembers everything. I'm sure Bill is going to have his team ready like he did back in the day, and you know, I'm sure Gino is going to have his team ready as well. And if you've had a chance to see him play, it's not too many days where he wasn't ready to play. So I'm actually going to be at the game, and I'm looking forward to watching them live as a fan for the first time.
Jamel, in one of tonight's games, Stanford will face Georgia. Is it fair to assume that if anybody beats UConn in this tournament, it'll be Stanford?
You know, that's definitely one of the teams that I would like to see play UConn again before the season's over. I think that'll probably be as good of a game as I think we can see in women's basketball this year. So I'm looking forward to the matchup in the Final Four, or if not the national championship game this year.
In addition to Connecticut, Iowa State, tomorrow we'll find Nebraska playing Kentucky. Nebraska has lost only one game this season. Have they impressed you in the tournament?
Absolutely. You know, I think it's always great in the sport of women's basketball to have a team like Nebraska. You know, I'd hate to use the words come from out of nowhere, but that's, you know, technically what they did. Before this season, nobody would have known or even had an idea of the type of success that Nebraska has had this year and continuing to have in the NCAA tournament. So I'm happy for them, and I'm definitely pulling for them to go, you know, as far as they can, except for when they play UConn, obviously. But, you know, you root for teams like that because you hope one day that you can be one of those teams.
All right, final question then. You've just completed your first year as a head coach at Cincinnati. You spoke about trying to recruit that one or two or perhaps three or four or five blue chippers. How long before we see you at the tournament again?
I'm really testing my patience now that I'm a head coach. I know it's going to take time and it's going to be a process, but we're moving in the right direction. And, you know, I'll just answer that question by saying hopefully it'll be sooner than later. But we're doing everything we can on our end and hoping that, you know, it'll be as early as next year.
Jamel Elliott, late a champion at UConn, is now the head coach of the women's team at the University of Cincinnati. Jamel, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I had a great time talking to you.
Major League Soccer averted a strike last Saturday. Just hours later, the New York Red Bulls opened their new arena with a sold-out exhibition against Santos of Brazil. The club spent $200 million on their Harrison, New Jersey stadium. New York is the eighth MLS team to build its own field, the latest in a growing trend the league and its fans hope will help ensure the longevity of MLS. Only a Game's Eugene Son reports.
The 25,000 fans only had to wait 11 minutes to see the New York Red Bulls score their first goal in the arena. That's how it sounded in the section behind New York's goal, home to the Empire Supporters Club. They sing, beat drums, and stand the whole game. The Red Bulls are courting these kinds of fans by letting them hang banners where advertising might be sold. Michael Sansone says it's a far cry from what it was like going to Red Bull games at Giants Stadium. Loud and obnoxious soccer fans made security personnel there nervous.
They didn't know what to do. They thought it was going to be a riot. They had images in their mind of something from, you know, Europe, but they were just having fun.
Red Bull Arena was purposely built walking distance from Newark's Ironbound neighborhood to attract the area's Portuguese and Brazilian fans. You can get Portuguese food at the concessions. They have their own cheering section. with so many yellow Brazilian jerseys in the stands that Lee Duarte questioned calling it a home opener.
For the Red Bulls, it's an away game. It's 95% Brazilian, brother.
But Will Koons, spokesman for Major League Soccer, says this is about more than just making games exciting for fans.
There's no looking back. There's no wondering, you know, will this league be here tomorrow? Red Bull's investment is just another signal to everyone that soccer really has arrived. We are a soccer country.
Victor Matheson, economics professor at Holy Cross College in Worcester, Massachusetts, says the league has suffered as the New York team struggled through ownership changes and even a name change. Matheson says MLS is hoping the arena is a fresh start for the Red Bulls.
There is no doubt that Major League Soccer has been disappointed with the Metro Stars and now the Red Bulls kind of throughout their existence. This really should be one of the flagship franchises, and it's never done well on the field.
MLS teams are building their own venues because they lose money when renting someone else's stadium. Matheson cites this example of the bad deal the Chicago team had when playing at Soldier Field, home of the NFL's Bears.
If they were to sell a Chicago Fire jersey at a Chicago Fire game at Soldier Field, the team itself actually made nothing from that sale.
Matheson says teams have equally bad terms for making money from food, beer, parking, and other items when they rent an arena. But a soccer stadium is no guarantee of success. Seven other MLS teams have them, only two. Seattle and Toronto made money in 2009, according to the league's commissioner. Last year, the Red Bulls had the worst record in the league and drew about 12,000 fans per game. Matheson says there's been intense speculation that the Red Bulls would try to bring in a big-name player from another league to draw crowds, as the LA Galaxy did signing David Beckham. Any such signings would not happen until after the World Cup is over. Red Bulls defender Mike Petke, who scored the second of the team's three goals at the home opener, says the pressure's on to win.
And they've built this $200 million cathedral for us, and the more I look around it, the more I realize that there really is no excuses anymore.
This $200 million bet on New York soccer will live or die on ticket sales. To maximize the fan experience, Red Bull Arena was not designed to be used for concerts. The team and the league are hoping the new home will kick up attendance the way Camden Yards did for the Baltimore Orioles. There's one more factor that could help. This season, Philadelphia joins the league. Tim Hall of the Empire Supporters Club says having a team in a rival city should help turn out fans.
The concept of taking a train or a bus for an hour to go tell people about them and their mother and their sister as well, forget it. We are over the moon.
Hey, it works for the Eagles and Giants and Phillies and Mets. For Only a Game, I'm Eugene Song.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Lately, Leo Messi has been scoring two goals a game for FC Barcelona, except for the games in which he's been scoring three. At a leading Catalan restaurant in Girona, the celebration of Messi's achievements has taken the form of a new dessert named for the striker. Jordi Roca, one of the three brothers who owns Cellar de Can Roca, has been working on the development of the delight for 6 months. He said recently, "We are making a dessert like one of Messi's goals." One supposes that this would mean the dessert would have to be artful, perhaps surprising, plentiful, and certainly crowd-pleasing. Except if the crowd was in Madrid. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the African roots of a Brazilian sport. But first, in 2001, 60 of the Lost Boys of Sudan moved north, way north, to Burlington, Vermont. Today, there are more than 200 Sudanese living in the city where they face challenges like establishing credit and finding jobs. Last year, Champlain College's Alex Brandstetter and about 30 of his fellow students staged Slam for Sudan, a charity basketball competition to benefit Sudanese living in their city. The second annual Slam for Sudan was held on Thursday night, and Alex Brandstetter joins me from the studios of Vermont Public Radio in order to tell me how it went. Alex, welcome to Only a Game.
Hi, how are you?
Also joining me is Alex Pial, a former Lost Boy and the director of Community Outreach for Global Reach Partnerships, the organization which benefited from Thursday night's events. Alex, welcome.
Thank you.
Alex Pial, I want to start with you. Can you describe some of the challenges you and your fellow Sudanese immigrants face in Burlington?
Well, that's a good question. Actually, when we came to this country, we came as a refugee, and the life we've been living in before is just only a matter of surviving of day-to-day life.
Mm-hmm.
When we came to this country, we don't have skills, and here we have to get our high school diplomas, and also you have to go to college, and then you'll be able to get a decent job. You know, the new country or the new culture, you have to learn slowly by slowly, one by one, and step by step.
Alex Brandstetter, what made you want to do something, and once you decided you wanted to do something, why a basketball tournament?
Well, the project started as a hypothetical class project in my international marketing class at Champlain College.
Mm-hmm.
And when the class was over, we put so much time and so much effort into the architecture of this idea of hosting an event to raise money and raise awareness for the Global Reach Partnerships. But when the class was over, we looked at each other and we said, listen, we did this so well, we put so much time into it, I think that it would be a slap in the face to just drop this. So I rallied my teammates and we gathered a whole bunch of other kids and we said, let's see this come to life, and we pulled it off.
All right, so this started as a class project, and eventually you drew 700 spectators and raised more than $14,000, so I assume you got an A.
Yeah, we got an A. But just to clarify, the $14,000 was just total donations. It was also in-kind donations.
Mm-hmm.
Tons of local businesses and organizations chipped in and helped us accomplish that goal.
The event is held at Champlain College, but you invite high school students from all over the state to participate in this slam dunk and three-point shot and skills competitions. Mm-hmm. Does anybody ever turn you down?
No, I approach the best players in the state. It's a fun event. It's a spectacle. It's getting all the kids in the state from all over the state together, and they get to celebrate Vermont basketball, but also the Sudanese culture. So,
Alex Pial, what was your organization able to do with the money that Champlain College students raised last year?
When the money was raised, we organized a workshop for the local Sudanese community here. We did two workshops, which one of them is financial and how you can manage your credit, how you can save your money, and how you manage them.
Mm-hmm.
We went through that workshop and went very successful. And the other one was the job training and the job skills, like how to write your resume and how to go through the job interview.
Alex Brandstetter, you staged the second annual Slam for Sudan on Thursday night. What, you needed extra credit, graduate credit? What's going on there?
I had a goal in mind that I wanted my school to adopt this project. I want it to be something that the school encourages the students to partake in, because ironically, Champlain College does not have sports, but we do have a lot of athletes. I think it's a cool dynamic to have a bunch of kids with no, you know, athletic program to put on a spectacle like this for high school kids. There was not as many people there because I think there was a lot of other things going on in Burlington. But the event as a whole was very successful, and I'm proud of all the people that helped it come together. And, you know, these kids were not getting class credit. They're not getting paid. It's just them donating their time and believing in this cause. I think that you don't get that too many places.
Alex Pial, many cities are less than welcoming of their immigrant populations. What has it been like for you to have your community, and especially the young members of your community, come out and support Sudanese immigrants in Vermont?
Well, especially in the Burlington area or Vermont in general, they are a very welcoming community. I've been visiting high school, middle school, even the kindergartens. I used to visit them and talk to them about my story, because the life we went through when we are young, when we are little, that's what inspired those people in Vermont to help us out. Like, we feel like we are at home. We feel like we have our own families here. We have, like, our brothers, and we have, like, our sisters.
You know, and I think also, just to add in here, you know, the kids that we had helping, we were successful in getting a message across that if you understand that there's a problem going on in the world and you choose to do nothing about it, then you are really part of the problem. You're part of the reason these problems exist. I think that really motivated us to look at each individual Sudanese community member and see, what do you need? What are the things that are making life tough for you? And when you hear their personal stories, especially, you know, I met Alex 2 or 3 years ago, and when I heard his story, you can't go home and live your life the way you were living it before. You have that little thing that just tells you that maybe there's something that you can do.
Alex Pial is the Director of Community Outreach for Global Reach Partnerships. Alex, thank you for joining me.
Thank you a lot. Not a problem.
And Alex Brandstetter is a senior at Champlain College and the founder of SLAM for Sudan. Alex, thank you as well.
Thank you very much for having me.
Africans were first brought to the New World in the early 16th century to work on sugar plantations. On these plantations, the dance martial art, now known as capoeira, was born. To celebrate the International Day of Remembrance for the victims of the transatlantic slave trade, which was this past Thursday, we're going to revisit the sport of capoeira and its journey back to Africa. Only a Game's Anjali Nair visited the first capoeira school in East Africa, and she has our report.
Rhythmic drumming echoes from the depths of Kenya's National Theater in Nairobi. Inside, 20 people are huddled in a circle singing and playing an exotic array of percussion instruments. In the center, two people whirl about in a cascade of kicks and acrobatics. Kick, sweep, flip. This is capoeira, and it has sprung up in gyms, parks, and community centers in North America and Europe. It first surfaced legally as a sport in Brazil in the 1930s. It then found its way to the streets of New York City in the 1970s, where it influenced the breakdancing movement, and after that, spread to Europe and Asia.
Control the kick, control the kick.
But this school, called Balanço Negro, or Black Swing, is East Africa's first. The group's teacher, Brian Owango, mixes graceful spins and cunning strikes in his game. A restaurateur by profession, Brian discovered capoeira 9 years ago during his university days in Manchester, England. There was something about the movement, the spirituality, and the familiarity of the game that drew the 30-year-old Kenyan in.
Well, in terms of percussion, that seemed familiar. There was something going on with the beats that I'd heard before. It was something that I knew, or something that I was supposed to know.
Capoeira emerged on the plantations of Brazil during the 16th and 17th century. While there is some debate about how the discipline evolved in the New World, its roots are distinctly African.
You know, history suggests that slavery at its height knew no region, no tribe. Take, for example, the fisherman from Angola, a drummer from the Congo, a hunter from Senegal, all put into one melting pot, Brazil. All their songs, their rituals, ceremonial chants, music, movements, martial traditions. Capoeira is a manifestation of this mix.
Part dance, part ritual, part deadly martial art, capoeira arose during the struggle for freedom from slavery. It's something that Owango, like most Kenyans, never learned about in his local school.
Hey, Tudor England, that's one thing we learned for ages and ages in school. You know, I can't quote any of it anymore, but it was very Eurocentric learning in high school for me. The history of the slave trade and, you know, the significance of certain companies and individuals in terms of African history, that's what we weren't taught in my school.
Three topics for the whole year, you remember? We started with the Romans, We went to the Anglo-Saxons, and this time we are going to talk about the Vikings.
20 years later, the curriculum still emphasizes European history. Brian's 9-year-old son, Zion, is now in grade 3.
During the Roman times, there was a very, very strong, powerful king. Can you remind me of that, the name of that king?
Today, Zion's class is learning about the Roman invasion of England.
In my school, I learned about Roman history. The Roman soldiers wanted to change their name to England to make it a better name.
It's in the evenings at capoeira class that Zion gets a dose of the other African history. Capoeira songs, some new and some old, form an oral account of the tradition. These types of songs have passed down information about what became of Brazil's slaves through generations and now over continents. Today, it's Zion's turn to lead the class. He chooses a song about a hawk catching a dove.
Pomba voou, pomba voou, pomba voou, gavião pegou.
Pomba voou, pomba voou,
pomba voou, gavião pegou.
The capoeira students are a mix of ages, classes, and ethnicities that represent the diversity of Kenya. From Brian's son Zion to Devon Solomon, a Liberian-Lebanese UN worker, and Bijal Raja, an Indian Kenyan who comes here with her 3 grown-up children. Each student defines the discipline in his or her own way.
Capoeira is a fight.
Capoeira is dance.
Capoeira is flow.
Capoeira is wholesome.
Capoeira is exercise.
Capoeira is concentration.
Capoeira is balance.
Capoeira is all-encompassing.
Capoeira is life.
41-year-old airport worker Moses Marivi had tried other classes like salsa and karate, but capoeira's physical and cultural aspects had him hooked.
The whole notion of it being Afrocentric made it especially interesting to us. I think there's a benefit of capoeira awakening the pride of the African in his heritage. Because once you understand that capoeira has a bit of Ashanti dance in there, a bit of Angolan dance in there, who's to say it doesn't have a little Maasai? Because the Maasai's traverse the whole of Africa. It gives us a chance to appreciate something that's not from the East or from the West, but it's African.
Wanna try this? Pushing harder, be in the water.
Tonight is a special class. Brian has brought in one of the oldest masters from his school's lineage in Santos, Brazil. Mestre Cascão is round and playful and clearly thrilled to be here.
Oh my God, I'm in Africa. Wow, that's something that I never imagined in my life, being in Africa. Capoeira comes from Africa, and it's kind of crazy for me being here.
Meeting Mestre Cascão is the closest most of these students will ever get to Brazil. But the learning is not one-sided. Cascão says as capoeira grew, it evolved into the flashy regional and contemporaneo styles. But in the process, some of the tradition of the old Angola style was lost. As an Angolan purist, he says that bringing capoeira back to Africa is the next step forward in its evolution and in his education.
I'd like to observe all the traditional dances. See, oh, this probably is Jinga, this probably is a Rabo de Arraia. Oh, this looks like capoeira. The seeds are here, you know, you brought the seeds there. And different trees grew there. And being capoeira here, you help a lot for us to have more information, to know more about history. Coming back to Africa, you can connect again.
For Only a Game, I'm Anjali Nair in Nairobi, Kenya.
You're listening to Only a Game. Recently, responses to Only a Game have been coming not only via our website, onlyagame.org, but also from our Facebook page, upon which Alan Bedford commented on this week's commentary about the New Jersey Nets fan who dismayed the team's CEO, Brett Yormark, by wearing a paper bag on his head. I'm surprised Brett Yormark shows up for games, much less that he doesn't put a bag on his own head, Mr. Bedford wrote. I would not be surprised if a lot more folks show up with paper bags for the next game. Karen Given's story about the recent winter croquet extravaganza in Vermont drew this comment from a listener named Dave. What a hoot! Great picks! I gotta see this live! So crowd control may be an issue at next year's intergalactic croquet event in Waterbury. Tim Kirchin's celebration of the longevity and excellence of baseball broadcaster Vin Scully irked Bill Schamleffer, who hears only a game on WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts. I agree that Vin Scully is one of the greatest baseball announcers ever, he wrote. But did Mr. Kirchin forget about Jack Buck, Ernie Harwell, Harry Callis, and Harry Carey? Please correct this terrible oversight. Ernie Harwell got a mention in the same context from Detroit listener Ron Zalewski. In Tim's defense, I'm sure he meant no slight to various other broadcasters in celebrating Vin Scully. Tim loves everybody connected with baseball. Norm Benson, who listens to the podcast of the show in Lower Lake, California, enjoyed my recent interview with Mike Young, the head coach of the Wofford College men's basketball team, in which Coach Young emphasized academics. Most college players won't make it to the NBA, he wrote. Mike Young is a true coach, instilling values in his players with lessons that will not be forgotten. Joan Epro, the Associate Dean of Academic Affairs at Franklin Pierce College in New Hampshire, would no doubt agree with that sentiment, but she emailed this week for another reason. We just happen to have our women's basketball team playing in the NCAA Division II Final Four this week, she wrote. We're all excited about this, and I was hoping that you might be, too. I am excited enough to mention it, though Franklin Pierce ended up losing in the semifinals to Fort Lewis. Condolences, Dean Epro. Check out our ever more chock-full website, onlyagame.org, and contact us from there, or leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can also become one of our Facebook fans at facebook.com/onlyagameradio, and you can follow us on Twitter at onlyagameradio. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Harvard University, whose Harvard Summer School offers courses for high school, college, and adult students to earn academic credit and experience Harvard campus life. Summer.harvard.edu. This is NPR.
For sports fans in the United States, spring means the culmination of college basketball's annual madness and the beginning of another Major League Baseball campaign. In Kyrgyzstan, on the other hand, celebration of the spring equinox includes kokburu, or goat grabbing, a competition sometimes compared to polo in which one team of players on horseback attempts to place the carcass of a goat in the opposite team's goal, while the opposite team, also mounted, attempts to prevent that occurrence by capturing the goat and depositing it in the goal at the other end of the field. Elements of this competition may strike U.S. fans as odd. The same can no doubt be said of fans in Kyrgyzstan with regard to the infield fly rule. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a new book about baseball's old days and the pitcher who dominated a lot of them. But first, Charlie Pierce joins me from member station KJZZ in Phoenix for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
In a tournament of upsets, a big one came on Thursday night. Number one Syracuse was bounced by Butler. What happened to the Mighty Orange?
The Mighty Orange were missing one of their big guys and their point guards, and their guards did not play really well. But I think it's about time to stop calling Butler a mid-major. Butler is a major program. It plays a major program schedule. It performs very well in the major program tournament every year. This is nowhere near as big an upset as people thought it was.
Charlie, the tournament has generated all sorts of intriguing numbers, of course. Here are two. 10, as in a 10-year contract, and 60, as in about a 60% raise in pay. That's apparently the reward for a head coach whose team knocks off a number one seed, in this case Kansas, early in the tournament. How much do you think Ben Jacobson would get if Northern Iowa manages to win it all someday?
Well, and a more interesting question is, how much would Ben Jacobson get if he was at a major university like a Kentucky or a Tennessee or someplace? He's still, I believe, under $1 million a year, which is chicken feed in college basketball coaching this year. But I would guess that he's going to be coaching at Northern Iowa for as long as if he wants to be the Ray Meyer of Northern Iowa, which I doubt he wants to be, he certainly could be.
All right, here's another intriguing basketball-related number, Charlie. 14. That's the number of shots Baylor's Brittany Griner blocked when her team beat Georgetown. You think she'll stop as many against Tennessee today?
Well, she'll have the opportunity, that's for sure, because Tennessee's going to put up a few of them. This is, of course, the same woman who became rather infamous earlier this season for smacking an opponent with a real haymaker. So it's nice to see that she's gotten things back on the rails and she's doing things properly on the court now.
The UConn women will face Iowa State today. In their last game against Temple, UConn led 50-12 at the half. As of Thursday, Iowa State coach Bill Fennelly had yet to watch a tape of that game. What, he doesn't think his team needs to prepare? They're that good?
Yeah, what was he going to learn? How Temple managed to gin up 12 points? I mean, what's to learn? And this is a tournament that consists of one team and everybody else. It's inconceivable to me that anybody is going to beat UConn in this tournament. And this is beyond what it used to be like when UCLA had the young Lou Alcindor or the young Bill Walton. These guys are just too good for the field.
In NBA basketball, the Atlanta Hawks clinched a playoff berth with a win this week, as did the Boston Celtics. So in this time of clinching, perhaps you would care to offer a prediction or two about the postseason in the NBA.
One prediction I will offer is if the Celtics play the Hawks will beat them. This is one of the great horses for courses matchups of all time. The Celtics cannot beat the Atlanta Hawks. That having been said, the Celtics are looking a lot better than they had over the previous couple of months, over the last 2 weeks. And I think they'll do pretty well in the playoffs as long as they don't play Atlanta.
Charlie, LeBron James told a reporter this week, and I'm quoting now, "If I really wanted to be the scoring champion every single year, I could really do it, but it doesn't matter." Normally, that kind of thing might get a guy accused of not playing up to his potential. So why are the Cavaliers so happy with what Mr. James has said?
Because he says it's more important to win as a team than be a scoring champion. I'm not entirely sure he's right. I think he could be the scoring champion every couple of years. I think he and Kobe Bryant would beat each other to death trying to do that if they wanted to. That's a fairly good quote for him to have in his record.
There is much off-season NFL news. New rules to protect defenseless players, new rules to govern overtime play. What are we going to see next? A new rule allowing touchdown celebrations?
I don't think we'll see that. But, yeah, they are very sensitive, obviously, to the very obvious notion that National Football League depends vitally on the destruction one way or another of the bodies of its players. This has become quite a point of emphasis over the last couple of years.
And do you like this new rule which changes the way overtimes will go?
Yes, because I got really tired of hearing in my head the referee saying, "New Orleans has won the toss and elected to win the game."
Meanwhile, lots of the guys hoping to break into the National Football League next season have been smoking marijuana. Or is lots an exaggeration?
Once again, the wonderful anonymous drug program that the NFL is so proud of is leaking like a sieve. There's some people concerned that maybe 10 or 12 players with first-round grades have had some sort of quote-unquote history with marijuana. The NFL will get over this, believe me. These kids will get drafted, they'll all play, and somehow the NFL will go merrily on. This is just a little bit of panic from some general managers who really don't understand very much of anything.
On Thursday, the National Hockey League Players Association voted to accept a new temporary rule that will ban hits to the head on, quote, unsuspecting players. We've been pretty hard on the National Hockey League of late, so maybe we should give the league props for this one?
Yeah, I think so. They certainly responded to a public embarrassment, which is very often the NHL's trajectory on these things, is to respond to a public embarrassment by an even bigger public embarrassment. So things are looking up. I don't understand why you can't ban headshots to suspecting players, for that matter.
Seems like
I don't understand why the unsuspecting players thing is thrown in there.
The grand jury investigating whether Roger Clemens lied to Congress has decided to go right to the source, Jose Canseco. They're going to call him as a witness. Do you suppose he'll begin his testimony by saying, as he did last year, quote, "What I speak out of my mouth is the truth, it burns like fire"?
That's very biblical of Jose, isn't it?
Wonderful.
It's really remarkable. Well, you know, the saying, of course, in law school is that a prosecutor can get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich. In this case, of course, the prosecutor is trying to get the grand jury to indict a meathead. But and in doing so, I might add, is bringing in one of the preeminent meatheads of all time to testify to it. I mean, I think Jose Canseco has run his mouth. Now let him run his mouth under oath.
Charlie, traditionally, appearing on the cover of Sports Illustrated has been regarded as something of a jinx. So, why is tennis great Andy Roddick so upset that he hasn't yet been on the cover?
Because his wife has been on the cover. Brooklyn Decker, the woman who was on the cover of the annual swimsuit issue this year, is married to Andy Roddick. Andy's got two choices. Either he can win something, which he's never managed to do, something big that gets the cover of Sports Illustrated, or he can change himself into a supermodel. I think the former is probably a little easier.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and of course he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
In baseball, as elsewhere, records are made to be broken, except for the one Old Hoss Radburn set in 1884. Pitching for the Providence Grays, Radburn tossed 73 complete games that season, and he won 59 of them. That achievement, the rollicking environment of pro baseball's early days, and curiosity about the most resilient and determined pitcher ever to take the mound, led Edward Acorn to write 59 in 84. Old Hoss Radburn, barehanded baseball, and the greatest season a pitcher ever had. The author joins me now from, appropriately enough, WRNI in Providence. Edward Acorn, welcome to Only a Game.
Hello, Bill.
In that most remarkable of seasons, Hoss Radburn started 73 of the 112 games the Providence Grays played. Were there any other pitchers on other teams who even came close to assuming a workload like that?
Well, there were some pitchers. There was a guy named Pud Galvin who pitched for Buffalo who started a lot of games. And there were pitchers in the other league, the American Association, who started a lot of games. But these guys did not come close to winning the way Radburn did.
It's tempting to compare Hoss Radburn's achievement in 1884 to the achievements of various 20-game winners today. But to what extent is such a comparison even possible?
Well, it's pretty hard to make an exact comparison. This guy threw 678 innings, and now if you throw 200 innings, you're considered a real workhorse. So the game was a little different back then. But I think Radburn's the kind of guy who was so gritty and determined and so smart that I think he would have thrived in any era.
There were a whole lot of other distinctions, though, between baseball now and baseball then. Teams in the 1880s might only carry two pitchers.
That's right. Radburn teamed up with a guy named Charlie Sweeney, and they were the two great pitchers of the time. It was very much a game where you had to go out every other day and throw your hardest.
Also, the pitchers of that day didn't have much in terms of physical rehabilitation, let alone surgery to correct torn rotator cuffs and things of that nature.
And no steroids. Yeah. Radburn's big performance-enhancing drug was whiskey, which he would drink in copious amounts to deal with the pain.
Upwards of a quart a day, you write at one point.
According to a relative, yeah. A relative said he drank a quart of whiskey at the height of his career, and I thought that sounds incredible, but then you go back and look at the clips, and they talk about his drinking from the very start of his career to his very last days on Earth. So he was a drinker.
You mentioned Charles Sweeney, and we ought to talk a little more about him. He won 17 games for the Grays in 84, and the rivalry between Sweeney and Radburn was a tremendous part of this book. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Radburn was a very jealous guy, and he didn't like that this younger hotshot pitcher had joined the team. And Sweeney really was a very fine pitcher. Years later, people talked about him as possibly the greatest pitcher they ever saw. Sweeney actually got the opening day start, and that really frosted Radburn. Things came to blows in mid-season when Sweeney got injured. His arm started to hurt too much, and Radburn really objected to having to pitch his games as well as his own without getting extra pay.
Hoss Radburn's story is not exclusively the tale of a nearly indestructible pitcher. He was also the main character in a love story of sorts. To what extent was the somewhat mysterious and perhaps dubious Carrie Stanhope an inspiration for old Hoss?
It's quite clear he loved her, and they stayed together the rest of their lives. She ran a rather questionable boarding house in downtown Providence. She was said to personally know every man in the National League. It seems pretty clear to me, although it's not absolutely certain, that this was a brothel. Radburn fell for her. He supposedly had a rival on another team. And there's even one legend after she died that was reported in the Boston Globe that he had won her in a baseball game, which I don't know if that's true, but it's a good story. And Radburn brought her back to his hometown of Bloomington, Illinois, and introduced her to his family as a widow and his wife, and she was neither at the time. They sort of lived in sin out there. But he eventually did marry her before he died. He died of syphilis at 43. But he made sure he married her before he died, and his money and savings went to her.
You quote Henry Chadwick, writing for the Brooklyn Eagle late in the 84 season, who said, "It is simply nonsense to assert that this is an arduous task for any man of the healthy class of athletes who compose the leading pitchers of the day. What Radburn has done, they can all do." Is there any record of a response to that contention?
The only response is no one ever did it again. I mean, that's a ludicrous assertion because Radburn really killed himself that season. He never approximated the numbers he did that year. He just worked incredibly hard. Then he went out and won all three games of the World Series, the first World Series ever played.
59 and 84 is as much about the context of Radburn's achievement as it is about the pitcher himself. As you researched Providence in the 1880s, what most surprised you?
I think this era is fascinating because it's about how tough it was to survive. I mean, this was a kind of country where it took really amazing grit and determination to survive and live. Radburn himself was a butcher before he became a ball player, and he said he knocked down a steer with a sledgehammer for 16 hours a day. And he said after that, throwing a baseball for 2 hours a day is pretty easy. As for Providence, it's interesting to just go back. I mean, they had a few telephones in town, but they almost had nothing, not really electric lights. Everything was transported by horse or on foot. Coal-fired stoves and all the pollution in the air and the stuff in the street and the sewage. And our ancestors had a tough time of it. And baseball was thriving in this period. And in fact, this is the period when baseball became the game we know it now.
We should talk a little bit about some of the differences between baseball in 1884 and baseball today, because some of those differences were significant in terms of Hoss Radburn's achievement. There was no pitching rubber. There was a pitching box, and the pitcher could move around in that box and throw from any part of it that he liked. On the other hand, when he hit a guy, the guy didn't get first base, right?
That's right, and pitchers would use that to intimidate and terrify hitters. And theoretically, an umpire could fine a pitcher for deliberately throwing at somebody, but that didn't happen very often because of the arguments that ensued. The big thing was baseball was played barehanded, if you can believe it. This is with a hard ball. It had a rubber center instead of a cork center, so it wasn't quite as resilient as the modern ball. But it could do real damage. And these fielders sustained broken fingers and just horrible injuries. It's quite amazing to read about it. The game was played most of the time in late afternoon, so the businessmen after their workday could go out to the ballpark. There were no lights, and so late in the afternoon, things started getting dark. And they played with one baseball the entire game, so it was filthy, dirty, with tobacco juice on it, hard to see. The ball would become very soft and sometimes soggy in the rain, and that helped the pitcher too. On the other hand, he's throwing every pitch of every inning, and he was expected to finish his games. You read about Radburn throwing 15 and 16 inning games that year, and they just had to get through.
75 starts, 73 complete games.
Actually, 73 starts, and he completed all 73 starts. The other two were relief appearances. Yeah. If you can believe that, tell that to a modern pitcher.
Edward Acorn is the author of 59 and 84, Old Hoss Radburn, Barehanded Baseball, and The Greatest Season a Pitcher Ever Had, published by Smithsonian Books. He joined me from WRNI in Providence. Ed, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill. It's a pleasure.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Tyler Murray. We had help this week from Sam Sanders at Vermont Public Radio and Bill Shedd at KJZZ in Phoenix, as well as James Baumgartner at WRNI in Providence. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo gallery, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, or listen to archived shows and stories, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on our Facebook and Twitter pages at Only a Game Radio. Our final word is from ESPN writer Pat Forty. I asked him how he's going to cope with the criticism from folks in Kentucky for discussing college basketball with an elitist from the Northeast.
Well, you know what? I can just say that you forced me to do it. I don't hang around with you. I don't associate with you, but I'll talk to you when you call my phone.
Yeah, nice try, Pat. We'll see you tomorrow at the barbecue, the Northeast barbecue. We'll have some trout almondine and scones and other elite food. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Mini, featuring the 37-mile-per-gallon Mini Cooper with go-kart handling. Learn more at miniusa.com/info. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.